The music at the Cavendish Ball did not stop when the Duke of Hawley entered, but the breathing of 400 guests certainly did. They called him the Ruined Duke. For 5 years, he had stood at the edge of every ballroom, leaning heavily on a carved wooden cane, a walking ghost bearing the brutal, puckered scars of a surviving man. No one looked him in the eye. No one spoke his name. And absolutely no one dared to ask him for a dance. Until she did. The air inside the Cavendish estate tasted of wilted lilies, beeswax, and the desperate sweat of the English aristocracy. It was the height of the season, and the ballroom was a suffocating crush of silk and expectation. Beatrice Croft sat rigidly on a gilded chair near the potted ferns, her hands folded over the dull green fabric of a dress that had seen 3 consecutive seasons. At 26, she was firmly entrenched in the invisible ranks of the unmarriageable. She preferred it that way. The invisibility offered a superb vantage point. From her corner, Beatrice watched the marriage mart execute its brutal nightly choreography. Young women with terrified eyes and bright forced smiles were paraded before bored men clutching glasses of sherry. It was an auction masquerading as a celebration. Beatrice hated the noise. She hated the frantic climbing ambition of it all. Most of all, she hated the collective cruelty of a room that decided a person's worth based entirely on symmetry and income. Her younger cousin Cecily was currently on the floor stumbling through a quadrille with a young viscount who looked remarkably like a nervous ferret. Beatrice tracked them with mild detachment, taking a sip of warm, flat champagne. Then the atmosphere shifted. It was not a sudden noise, but rather a sudden vacuum. The low buzzing hum of 400 overlapping conversations faltered, dropping a full octave before dissolving into a tense, vibrating silence. Even the string quartet seemed to miss a beat, the lead violinist's bow dragging harshly across the gut strings. Beatrice set her glass down. She knew that silence. It meant only one thing. Edmund Hawley, the Duke of Richmond, had arrived. He stood in the arched double doorway of the ballroom. He did not look angry. He did not look ashamed. He looked completely, utterly resigned to the reaction his presence commanded. He was a tall man, broad-shouldered, and dressed in impeccably tailored stark black evening wear that offered no concessions to the current fashion for bright waistcoats. His right hand gripped the silver head of a heavy oak cane. As he stepped forward, the sound of his cane hitting the polished parquet floor cut through the quiet. Click, drag, click. The crowd parted. It was a fluid, deeply insulting movement. Men and women alike drifted backward, turning their shoulders, ensuring a wide empty berth of at least 6 feet existed between themselves and the Duke. They did not run. They merely arranged themselves so that he was constantly surrounded by an island of empty space. Beatrice watched him walk. His right leg was stiff, the limp pronounced and heavy. It took visible effort for him to propel himself forward, his jaw tight with the exertion. But the limp was not what made the matrons clutch their daughter's arms. It was his face. 5 years ago, a fire had gutted the west wing of his country estate. The official story was that he had gone back in for a ledger. The truth whispered by the servants, and completely ignored by the ton, was that he had gone back for a trapped scullery maid. He had saved her, but the burning roof had collapsed. The left side of his face was untouched, aristocratic, sharp-featured, with a dark, intelligent eye. But the right side bore the devastating map of the fire. The skin was tightened, roped with pale, shiny burn scars that stretched from his temple down across his jaw, pulling the corner of his mouth into a perpetual, slight grimace. His collar was high, attempting to hide the burns that crawled down his neck, but the damage was undeniable. It was raw. It was physical. It was real. In a room obsessed with flawless porcelain skin and symmetrical perfection, Edmund Hawley was an intrusion of brutal reality. He did not attempt to mingle. He made his slow, methodical way to the far wall furthest from the orchestra. He stopped near a heavy velvet curtain, planted his cane, and leaned his weight against the wall. He crossed his arms over his chest. He looked out at the room with a gaze so fiercely blank it made Beatrice's chest ache. Slowly the noise returned to the ballroom. The string quartet struck up a waltz. The dancers moved back onto the floor, but the invisible barrier remained. The swirling couples instinctively swung wide as they passed his corner, treating him like a pillar or a potted plant. A hazard to be avoided. Beatrice watched a group of young men in military dress standing a few yards from him. They were laughing, darting quick sideways glances at the Duke. One of them mimicked a limp taking a dragging step, and the others snickered behind their gloved hands. Beatrice felt a cold, hard knot form in her stomach. It was not pity. Pity was useless. What she felt was a sudden violent surge of disgust. Disgust for the snickering men. Disgust for the mothers shielding their eyes. Disgust for the entire fragile, cowardly society that could not stomach the sight of a man who bore the physical evidence of having lived and suffered in the real world. She looked back at Edmund. He had seen the young men mocking him. He didn't react. He simply tightened his grip on the silver head of his cane, his knuckles turning white, his jaw clenching so hard the scarred tissue pulled taut. He was used to it. He expected it. He stood there and took it night after night, refusing to be banished from his own society, yet entirely trapped within it. Beatrice looked down at her hands. She was a spinster. She had no reputation to protect, no matrimonial prospects to ruin. She had nothing to lose. The waltz swelled, the music rising to a crescendo. Beatrice stood up. She smoothed the front of her dull green skirt. She did not look at Cecily. She did not look at her aunt. She stepped out from behind the safety of the potted ferns and began to walk across the floor. The walk across the Cavendish ballroom felt like wading through deep water. Beatrice did not hurry. Her strides were measured, her chin level. As she moved away from the fringes and cut directly through the center of the room, the perimeter of dancing couples began to notice. First, there was a ripple of confusion. A woman walking alone, unescorted, directly across the active dance floor was a breach of protocol. Then, as the trajectory of her path became clear, the murmurs started. Where is the Croft girl going? Is she unwell? Good God, she's heading straight for the corner. Beatrice ignored the whispers. She kept her eyes fixed on the man in black. Edmund saw her coming when she was 10 yards away. His good eye narrowed. The rigid posture he maintained grew even stiffer. He shifted his weight slightly, leaning harder on the cane, bracing himself. He expected a mistake. Perhaps she was lost. Perhaps she was coming to retrieve a stray fan. When she stopped directly in front of him, invading that 6-foot ring of isolation, the ton had so carefully constructed, the music seemed to drop away entirely. The young men who had been mocking him fell silent, staring openly. Beatrice stood close enough to smell the faint scent of sandalwood soap and the lingering permanent trace of wood smoke that clung to his clothes. Close up, the scars were harsher, deeply textured, the skin a pale, shiny contrast to the healthy tan of his left cheek. She looked directly at his face, letting her eyes rest on the burns for a fraction of a second, acknowledging them not flinching before meeting his dark, wary eye. "Your Grace," she said. Her voice was quiet, steady-pitched, just for him. Edmund looked down at her. His expression was a fortress. "Miss Croft, isn't it?" His voice was gravel-scraped raw, bearing the faint, raspy damage of smoke inhalation. "Are you lost? The punch bowl is behind you." "I am perfectly aware of the room's geography, Your Grace," Beatrice replied flatly. "I'm here to ask if you would care to dance." For a long moment, Edmund did not move. He stared at her, searching her face for the punchline. His grip on the cane trembled slightly before he forced it still. When he spoke, his tone was laced with a defensive, bitter acid. "Is this a wager, Miss Croft, or perhaps a sudden overwhelming bout of Christian charity? Let me save you the trouble. I do not require your pity." "I don't have any pity to spare," Beatrice said, her tone matching his hardness. "I am simply irritated by the profound cowardice of everyone in this room, and I wish to dance. You're the only man not currently sweating through his collar while stepping on a debutante's toes. So I will ask again, will you dance with me?" Edmund's jaw worked. He looked past her at the room of staring faces, the dozens of people pausing in their steps to watch the spectacle. A muscle feathered in his ruined cheek. "I am a cripple," he stated, brutally wielding the word like a weapon to drive her away. "I cannot waltz. I drag my leg." "I am aware of how legs work, Your Grace," Beatrice countered. "I possess two of my own. I have no desire to spin like a top. A slow measure will do. Or are you as cowardly as they are?" It was a massive risk, a profound insult to a duke. Edmund's head snapped back slightly, a flash of genuine anger sparking in his eye. Then slowly the anger shifted into something else, a grim, dark resignation tinged with the faintest shadow of respect. He looked at her hand hanging at her side. Slowly, deliberately, he shifted his cane to his left hand. He held out his right arm. "You will regret this, Miss Croft." "I regret most things," Beatrice said, placing her gloved hand lightly on his dark sleeve. "I doubt this will make the top 10. He led her onto the floor. Click, drag, click. It was excruciatingly slow. The crowd actively scrambled backward to make room, their eyes wide with shock. Beatrice kept her gaze locked on the lapel of his coat. When they reached the edge of the dancing couples, Edmund turned to face her. He did not offer the standard light frame of a waltz. He couldn't. He had to keep the cane in his left hand to support his weight. "Put your hand on my shoulder," he instructed, his voice low, strictly professional. "You will have to guide the turns. I will pivot on the right leg." Beatrice stepped in. She placed her right hand not in his, but firmly on his shoulder, anchoring herself. He wrapped his right arm around her waist. His grip was entirely unlike the polite, hovering touch of the other men. It was a heavy, necessary hold. He was using her for balance. She could feel the solid, tense muscle beneath the wool of his coat, the physical strain radiating from his body. The orchestra, realizing they were actually going to dance, faltered before the conductor frantically waved them into a slower, sweeping tempo. They moved. It was not graceful. It was a mechanical grinding effort. Step. Drag. Pivot. Beatrice felt the immense weight of him every time he shifted onto his bad leg. She had to brace her core, pushing back slightly against his shoulder to keep them upright during the turns. It was actual physical labor.
"You're doing all the work," he murmured roughly near her ear, his breath warm against her temple. "I have broad shoulders," she replied, keeping her eyes fixed over his shoulder at the blurring, staring faces of the crowd. "Stop apologizing. Just keep the time." He barked out a short, rusty sound that might have been a laugh. His grip on her waist tightened slightly, securely. They did not speak again for the duration of the song. They focused purely on the mechanics of movement, two bodies negotiating gravity and injury in the middle of a gilded cage. Beatrice felt the heat radiating from him, saw a bead of sweat trace the edge of the scar on his jaw. He was working incredibly hard just to keep them moving in a circle. There was no romance in the movement. There was only survival and defiance. When the final chord struck, they stopped. Edmund was breathing heavily, his chest rising and falling against hers. He released her waist, immediately leaning his weight back onto the cane. The ballroom was dead silent. No one was clapping. Edmund looked down at Beatrice. The defensive hostility was gone from his good eye, replaced by a raw, exhausted vulnerability. "Thank you," he said softly. Beatrice offered him a short, sharp nod. "The pleasure was mine, Your Grace." She turned entirely unbothered by the hundreds of eyes drilling into her back and walked calmly back to her chair by the ferns. The carriage ride home from the Cavendish estate had been conducted in a silence so thick it felt like chewing on wool. Beatrice's aunt Sybil had sat rigid in the darkness, her jaw clamped tight enough to crack a molar. Cecily had wept softly into her gloved hands, mourning the sudden violent death of her own matrimonial prospects. A spinster cousin was an annoyance. A spinster cousin who openly courted the ruined duke was a social contagion. Morning brought no relief. The breakfast room in the Croft townhouse was freezing.
The maid had laid the fire poorly, and the damp London chills seeped through the window panes. Beatrice sat at the long mahogany table, methodically buttering a piece of cold toast. She was entirely alone. By 10 o'clock, the first tangible consequence arrived. The heavy brass knocker sounded, and the butler returned bearing a silver salver. On it rested a thick cream envelope. It was an uninvitation to the Duchess of Marlborough's garden party, penned with chilling politeness. By noon, 3 more letters arrived. The Croft women were officially exiled. Aunt Sybil finally materialized at 1 o'clock. She did not yell. Yelling was for the lower classes. She stood in the doorway of the parlor, her face a mask of pale aristocratic fury. "You have destroyed us," Sybil stated. The words dropped like stones onto the Persian rug. "Cecily has not stopped crying since we left the ballroom. The Earl of Danbury's son was meant to call today. He has not. He will not. You have dragged our name into the gutter just to satisfy some bizarre, perverse need for attention." Beatrice looked up from her embroidery. She was attempting to repair a frayed hem on a sensible gray day dress. "I asked a man to dance, Aunt. I did not murder the Prime Minister." "You asked a monster to dance," Sybil hissed, stepping into the room. Her composure fractured just slightly. "A man who looks like a burned corpse. A man society has rightfully ostracized. They do not shun him for his face, Beatrice. They shun him for the reminder of his recklessness. And now they will shun us. They shun him because looking at him requires them to acknowledge that bad things happen to titled men," Beatrice replied, evenly snapping her thread. "It disturbs their illusion of safety. I refuse to play along with such profound stupidity."
"Then you will starve with your principles," Sybil said bitterly. "Your father left you nothing. I have housed you out of obligation. That obligation ends the moment Cecily is settled. If she cannot marry because of the stench you have attached to this house, I will send you to a decaying cottage in Cornwall, and you will rot there." Sybil turned and swept from the room. Beatrice set her sewing aside. Her hands were shaking slightly. Not from fear, but from the massive, suffocating pressure of being entirely dependent on people she despised. Sybil was right. The trap had always been there. Beatrice had simply chosen to finally spring it. The walls of the parlor suddenly felt unbearably close. She needed air. Beatrice did not bother with a maid. She pinned a plain woolen pelisse over her dress, tied a dark bonnet securely under her chin, and walked out the front door. The streets of Mayfair were bustling with the early afternoon traffic. She kept her head down, walking briskly toward Hyde Park. The damp air felt good against her flushed cheeks. She turned onto a quiet, gravel-strewn walking path near the Serpentine. It was sparsely populated, favored by elderly couples and solitary walkers. The gray water of the lake lapped sluggishly against the muddy bank. "You walk exactly as you dance, Miss Croft, with a complete disregard for anyone in your way." Beatrice stopped. Sitting on an iron bench beneath the bare branches of a massive oak tree was Edmund Hawley. He was dressed in a heavy black greatcoat, the collar turned up against the wind. His cane rested between his knees, both hands resting heavily on the silver pommel. In the harsh, flat daylight of the park, his scars were even more pronounced. The damaged skin pulled tightly over the bone raw and weathered. He looked tired. There were deep, bruised shadows under his eyes. The physical exertion of the previous night had clearly exacted a toll. Beatrice approached the bench. She did not ask for permission before sitting down on the opposite end, leaving 3 feet of cold iron between them. "Are you following me?" "Your Grace," she asked, her tone conversational. "I have a townhouse overlooking the park." Edmund said, his raspy voice grating against the wind. He did not turn his head to look at her, keeping his good eye fixed on the gray water. "I come to this bench every afternoon. You are the one intruding on my territory." "My apologies. I was unaware the Duke of Hawley laid claim to municipal ironmongery." A heavy silence stretched between them. A mallard duck splashed into the water near the bank, breaking the quiet. "Why did you do it?" Edmund asked suddenly. The hostility was back sharp and defensive. And do not give me that nonsense about the music. No woman ruins herself for a waltz.
Beatrice looked at his profile, the rigid, perfect line of his left jaw and the jagged, ruined ruin of his right.
My aunt informed me this morning that I am to be banished to Cornwall. The invitations to the Croft household have been entirely severed. I am aware of how society functions, Edmund said coldly. You have achieved social suicide. What did you hope to gain?
Nothing, Beatrice said simply. I gained absolutely nothing.
Edmund finally turned his head to look at her. His dark eye was hard, searching her face for the lie.
People do not act without a motive, Miss Croft.
My motive was a profound lack of patience.
Beatrice answered, her voice dropping into a low, fierce register.
I was tired of watching them pretend you didn't exist. I was tired of sitting in a corner pretending my own life wasn't a slow, grinding death of boredom and dependency. For 3 minutes, I decided not to be invisible. I chose to do exactly what I wanted to do.
Edmund stared at her. The wind whipped a stray lock of dark hair across his scarred cheek. He didn't brush it away.
You are a fool, Miss Croft.
Perhaps, Beatrice agreed, staring out at the water. But at least I'm a fool of my own making.
Edmund watched Beatrice. She was not a conventionally beautiful woman. Her features were too sharp, her jaw too square, her coloring too pale. She lacked the soft, rounded compliance that men of his station were taught to prize. Yet sitting rigidly on the freezing iron bench, she possessed an immovable, solid gravity that fascinated him. His right leg throbbed with a dull, sickening ache. The dance had torn something in his damaged thigh muscle. He had spent the morning gripping the edge of his wash basin, waiting for the spasms to pass. It was a humiliating reality. But as he looked at the spinster who had caused the pain, he found he did not regret it.
If you are bound for Cornwall, Edmund said, his voice dropping an octave, how exactly do you intend to survive? The Croft estate is famously impoverished.
I will manage, Beatrice said tightly. I can manage a household. I read voraciously. I will likely become incredibly eccentric and die at an advanced age surrounded by feral cats.
A compelling prospect.
Edmund shifted his weight, his leather gloves squeaking against the silver cane. He stared at his hands. He was a man who planned. Before the fire, he had plotted crop yields, parliamentary votes, and strategic alliances with military precision. The fire had burned his life down to the studs. But the architect inside him remained. An idea had taken root in his mind the moment she had placed her hand on his shoulder in the ballroom. It was a cold, pragmatic idea. Now, sitting beside her, the logic of it became undeniable.
My heir is my cousin Alistair, Edmund stated abruptly.
Beatrice blinked, thrown by the sudden shift in topic.
I'm not familiar with him. You should consider yourself fortunate.
Alistair is a gambling addict with the moral backbone of a jellyfish. He is currently waiting for me to succumb to a sudden infection, or perhaps throw myself off a bridge so he can liquidate the Hawley estate and pay off his markers in Macau.
That sounds terribly inconvenient for you, Beatrice noted dryly.
It is. My solicitors inform me that if I die without issue, Alistair will dismantle 300 years of careful stewardship within a decade. The tenant farmers will be ruined. The land will be sold for parts.
Edmund turned fully toward her.
The damaged side of his face caught the dull gray light. He did not flinch or hide it. He let her see exactly what he was.
I need a wife, Miss Croft.
Beatrice did not gasp. She did not widen her eyes. She sat perfectly still, processing the words with the calculating speed of a woman who had spent her entire life assessing risks.
A wife, she repeated flatly.
A wife?
He confirmed.
And eventually an heir. Though I am well aware of the physical revulsion my appearance causes, I do not expect a love match. I expect a business arrangement.
Why me?
The question was blunt, completely devoid of false modesty.
Because you are ruined,
Edmund said, matching her bluntness.
Any woman of rank my solicitors approach would rather enter a convent than look at my face across a dining table. You, however, have already touched me in public. You did not faint. You did not weep. You possess an iron spine, and you are currently staring down the barrel of poverty in Cornwall. He leaned forward slightly, resting his forearms on his cane. The intensity radiating from him was palpable. I offer you a dukedom. You will have unlimited funds. You will have your own wing of the house in London and your own wing at the country estate. You may decorate as you please. You may buy as many feral cats as you desire. You will have absolute financial independence. Beatrice looked at him. And in return you will stand beside me in public when necessary. You will manage my estates, a task I suspect you will excel at, and you will bear me a son. He swallowed, his throat working. The pragmatism in his voice cracked just a fraction. I will not force myself upon you. We will perform the act strictly for the purpose of succession in darkness, if you prefer. Once a son is born, you need never share my bed again. It was the most brutally unromantic proposal in the history of England. It was a transaction of flesh and title, stripped of all polite fiction. Beatrice looked down at her hands, still encased in their worn woolen gloves. She thought of Aunt Sybil's cold, triumphant face. She thought of the dripping, damp ceiling of a cottage in Cornwall. She thought of the rest of her life stretching out before her like a gray, endless corridor of begging for scraps from relatives who despised her. Then she looked at Edmund. She saw the tight control in his shoulders, the exhaustion in his eyes. He was offering her a fortress. It was a fortress guarded by a scarred, bitter man, but it was a fortress nonetheless. I require a separate budget for my own charities, Beatrice said. Her voice was steady, betraying none of the adrenaline flooding her veins. I will not ask permission to spend my own money, and my cousin Cecily is to be provided a dowry. It is the only way my aunt will ever forgive me, and I wish to purchase her silence. Edmund's good eye widened slightly. A flare of genuine surprise followed swiftly by a deep rumbling sound in his chest. It took Beatrice a moment to realize he was laughing. It was a rusty, unused sound. You are negotiating, he murmured, shaking his head. I am ensuring my terms, she corrected. I am agreeing to sell my life to you, Your Grace. I intend to get a fair price, a separate budget, and a dowry for the weeping cousin. Done. Edmund shifted his cane to his left hand. He held out his right hand encased in black leather. It was not a gesture asking for a dance. It was a businessman sealing a contract. Beatrice unclasped her hands. She reached out and placed her hand firmly in his. His grip was strong, calloused, and unyielding. We have an arrangement, Duke. We do, Miss Croft. Edmund held her hand for a second longer than necessary. My solicitors will call on your aunt this evening. I suggest you pack. The solicitor arrived at the Croft townhouse precisely at 6 o'clock that evening. Mr. Penhaligon was a dry, colorless man who spoke exclusively in ledgers, yields, and legally binding clauses. Aunt Sybil sat in the parlor, her face a terrifying mask of conflicting emotions. The horror of the Duke's reputation warred visibly against the sheer, undeniable weight of his wealth. When Penhaligon produced the draft detailing Cecily's dowry, a sum so staggering it made Sybil physically grip the arms of her chair, the moral outrage evaporated. Sybil signed the necessary guardian consents without reading the finer print. She did not look at Beatrice once. The wedding took place 3 days later. It was an exercise in bleak efficiency. There were no white silk roses, no gossiping throngs, and no choir. They married on a Tuesday morning in a small damp chapel in Marylebone while a light freezing rain battered the stained glass windows. Beatrice wore her best walking dress, a deep navy wool that offered no concession to bridal traditions. Edmund wore his customary stark black. He stood at the altar leaning heavily on his cane, his jaw clenched, staring straight ahead. The vicar rushed through the vows, his eyes darting nervously away, every time he accidentally caught a glimpse of the Duke's ruined profile. When Edmund slid the heavy gold ring onto Beatrice's finger, his hand was ice cold. He did not kiss her. The vicar did not suggest it.
They signed the registry in silence, the scratch of the quill echoing loudly in the empty stone church. They stepped out of the chapel, not as lovers, but as business partners.
The Hawley carriage was waiting at the curb. It was a massive, glossy, black, crest-emblazoned vehicle pulled by four matching grays. As Edmund handed her inside, the physical reality of what she had done finally settled over Beatrice. The heavy door clicked shut, sealing them together in the velvet-lined interior. The smell of sandalwood and old leather enveloped her.
Edmund sat opposite her, his cane braced between his knees. He looked utterly exhausted. The tight lines around his mouth suggested his leg was giving him hell. "Hawley House is fully staffed," he said, staring out the window at the rain-slicked streets. "The housekeeper, Mrs. Higgins, is entirely competent. You will find your private apartments in the East Wing. They have been aired and prepared. My chambers are in the West Wing." "A considerable distance," Beatrice noted. "I prefer quiet," he replied curtly. "And I suspect you will appreciate the barrier." Beatrice did not argue. She watched the grim gray architecture of London roll past. She had traded one cage for another, but this cage was built of solid gold, and she was the one holding the key.
Hawley House was not a home. It was a monument. Situated behind a high iron gate in Mayfair, the limestone facade was intimidating, boasting imposing columns and narrow, judgmental windows. When the heavy double doors opened, a line of silent, meticulously dressed servants waited in the grand foyer.
Edmund stepped over the threshold. The familiar click-drag-click of his cane echoed against the marble floors. He did not introduce her to the staff. He merely gestured to a severe-looking woman in a black bombazine dress. "Mrs. Higgins will show you to your rooms. I have business in my study." He turned away without waiting for a response, his slow, dragging gait taking him down a long, shadowed corridor. Beatrice stood in the center of the massive foyer. The servants watched her with carefully blank faces. They were expecting a shrinking, terrified girl. They were expecting the ruined Duke's latest victim. Beatrice unpinned her damp bonnet and handed it to a waiting footman. She did not tremble. She did not look at the floor. She looked directly at Mrs. Higgins. "I prefer my tea at 4 o'clock. Mrs. Higgins," Beatrice said, her voice clear and carrying perfectly in the cavernous space. "Strong with no sugar, and I require a desk placed in my sitting room by tomorrow morning, a large one. I have estate ledgers to review." Mrs. Higgins blinked a flicker of surprise, breaking her stoic facade. "Right away, Your Grace." Beatrice followed the housekeeper up the sweeping marble staircase. The east wing was stunningly opulent. Her apartments consisted of a massive bedchamber draped in heavy gold silk, a private sitting room, and a dressing room larger than her entire previous home. A fire crackled in the marble hearth, chasing away the autumn chill. When the door clicked shut, leaving her alone, Beatrice walked to the center of the room. She ran her hand over the polished mahogany of a side table. She had her own fire. She had her own space. No one would ever tell her she was a burden again. But as she looked at the massive, empty four-poster bed dominating the room, the second half of her contract loomed in the shadows. The heir. The business transaction they had yet to complete. Her stomach gave a slow, complicated twist. Dinner was served at 8 o'clock in a dining room built to intimidate visiting royalty. A vast expanse of polished mahogany stretched like a barren wasteland between the Duke at the head of the table and the Duchess at the foot. Beatrice looked down the 30 feet of dark wood past four towering silver candelabras and a massive floral centerpiece to where Edmund sat in rigid silence. They ate two courses without exchanging a single word. The only sounds were the clinking of silver on porcelain and the quiet, synchronized movements of the footmen. It was absurd. It was deeply, profoundly lonely. Beatrice set her fork down. "This is ridiculous." Edmund paused his wine glass halfway to his mouth. He looked down the table at her, his good eye narrowed. "Is the mutton overcooked?" "The mutton is fine. The geography is the problem." Beatrice stood up. She picked up her plate, her wine glass, and her napkin. She walked past three startled footmen, ignoring their wide eyes, and marched down the length of the table.
She pulled out the chair directly to Edmund's right and sat down. She placed her plate on the table with a firm click. Edmund stared at her, genuinely taken aback. "What are you doing?" "I am eating my dinner," Beatrice said, picking up her fork. "I have spent my entire life being ignored in corners. I refuse to spend the rest of it shouting across a room just to ask for the salt, if we are to be partners." "Your Grace, we will eat like human beings, not rival monarchs." A heavy silence fell over the room. The footman looked terrified, waiting for an explosion. Edmund looked at her. Up close, the candlelight flickered harshly across the deep grooves of his scars. He searched her face for pity or disgust, finding only calm, stubborn pragmatism. Slowly, the tight lines of his jaw relaxed. He gestured to the footman. "Leave us," he ordered. The servants vanished, closing the heavy doors behind them. Edmund reached out and pushed the silver salt cellar toward her. "You are a very strange woman, Beatrice."
It was the first time he had used her given name. It sounded rough and unpracticed in his damaged voice.
"I am a practical woman," she corrected. "And practically speaking, shouting ruins digestion." They finished the meal in a quiet, fragile truce. But as the clock in the hall struck 10, the comfortable silence shattered. The hour had arrived. The contract demanded fulfillment. The tension in the room spiked, suddenly suffocating. Edmund set his napkin down. His hands were gripping the edge of the table so tightly his knuckles were white. "I will come to your chambers in an hour," he said. His voice was entirely flat, stripped of all emotion. It was a business schedule. Beatrice swallowed hard. "Very well." The hour stretched like a decade. Beatrice prepared for bed mechanically. She dismissed her new maid early, donning a plain, heavy cotton nightgown instead of the delicate silk trousseau pieces her aunt had hastily procured. She brushed her hair, braided it tightly down her back, and sat in the armchair by the fire. At precisely 11 o'clock, the heavy oak door opened. Edmund stepped inside. He had discarded his coat and cravat. He wore only dark trousers and a white linen shirt open at the collar. Without the structured coat, his physical vulnerability was glaring. The firelight caught the edge of the burn scars, disappearing beneath the linen of his shirt, confirming that the damage extended far beyond his face. He leaned heavily on his cane, his breathing slightly elevated. He closed the door behind him. He did not look at her. He limped directly toward the bedside table, where a single oil lamp burned low. He reached out to turn the brass knob and plunge the room into absolute darkness. "Leave it," Beatrice said. Edmund froze his hand, hovering over the lamp. "I told you. I will not subject you to the sight of me. We can do this in the dark. I do not sleep with ghosts, Edmund," Beatrice said, standing up from the armchair. Her voice was quiet, but it held no tremble. "And I will not treat you like a monster that must be hidden away. Leave the light." He turned his head slowly. The raw, unprotected shock in his eye was agonizing to witness. He expected revulsion. He had braced himself for her tightly shut eyes and gritted teeth. Her demand for the light broke a fundamental law of his isolated existence. He slowly lowered his hand from the lamp. He turned to face her fully. Beatrice walked toward him. Her heart was hammering against her ribs, a frantic bird trapped in her chest, but she kept her gaze steady. When she stood inches away from him, she stopped. She could feel the heat radiating from his skin. He was rigidly tense, waiting for the blow, waiting for her to flinch. Beatrice reached out. Her hand trembled slightly, but she did not pull back. She placed her fingertips lightly against his left cheek, the unblemished side. His skin was warm, his jaw clenched like iron. Then slowly, deliberately, she moved her hand across his face. She traced the boundary where smooth skin met ruined tissue. She let her fingers brush over the tight-roped scars on his right cheek. They felt rough, thick, and deeply textured. Edmund sucked in a sharp, ragged breath. He closed his eye. A visible shudder ripped through his broad shoulders. "Don't," he whispered a broken, scraped sound. "Please. It is just skin," Beatrice said softly,
her thumb brushing the tightened corner of his mouth.
It is just you. You survived. There is no shame in surviving.
He opened his eye. He looked at her, searching the depths of her face for the lie, for the hidden disgust. He found none. The heavy protective armor he had worn for 5 years cracked, fracturing down the center. He dropped his cane. It hit the carpet with a dull thud. He reached out with both hands, grabbing her waist as if he were a drowning man, and she was the only solid ground left in the world. He pulled her against his chest, burying his face in the curve of her neck. He was shaking. Beatrice wrapped her arms around his shoulders, holding him back, feeling the heavy, solid weight of a man who had finally been allowed to stop fighting. Morning broke over London in a wash of pale, bruised gray. The rain had stopped, leaving the streets slick and the air heavy with dampness. Inside the east wing of Hawley House, the fire had burned down to glowing embers. Beatrice woke first. She did not move immediately. She lay still, staring at the heavy gold canopy overhead, feeling the unfamiliar solid weight of the man sleeping beside her. Edmund was on his stomach, his scarred cheek pressed into the white linen pillow. In sleep, the harsh defensive lines of his face were smoothed away. He looked exhausted, but the rigid tension that usually governed his body was gone. The heavy wool blankets had slipped down, revealing the broad expanse of his back and the thick, puckered burn scars that tracked over his right shoulder blade. She did not feel regret. She felt a profound, grounding certainty. The transaction had been completed, but the mechanical coldness they had both anticipated had never materialized. Instead, there had been a desperate quiet grasping in the dark, two people abandoned by the world finding a brief, necessary harbor in each other. Beatrice quietly slipped from the bed. She pulled on a heavy velvet wrapper, tying the sash tightly against the morning chill. When she entered her private sitting room, she found Mrs. Higgins had been true to her word. A massive mahogany desk dominated the space near the window, piled high with leather-bound ledgers and a fresh silver inkwell. Beatrice rang for tea, stoked the fire herself, and sat down. She did not open a prayer book or write a letter to her aunt. She cracked open the master ledger for the Hawley Estate's Northern Tenant Farms. For 3 hours, the only sound in the room was the scratching of her quill and the crisp turn of parchment pages. Numbers were beautiful. They did not lie. They did not care about a person's face or their dowry. They simply balanced, or they did not. By 9 o'clock, she had found a glaring problem. Beatrice gathered the heavy book, picked up a piece of blotting paper loaded with her notes, and walked out of her apartments. She did not bother to dress for the day. She navigated the long, quiet corridors of the West Wing, ignoring the surprised glances of the footmen she passed. She reached the heavy oak doors of the Duke's study and knocked once before pushing them open. Edmund was already at his desk. He was fully dressed in black, his cane resting against the arm of his leather chair. A half-empty cup of black coffee sat beside a stack of correspondence. He looked up, his good eye widening slightly at the sight of her in her velvet wrapper, her hair falling out of its loose braid. "Is something wrong?" he asked, his voice rough with sleep and suspicion. "Mr. Hopkins," Beatrice said bluntly, walking directly to his desk. She dropped the heavy ledger onto the polished wood with a loud smack. "Your steward for the Yorkshire properties. He is robbing you blind." Edmund blinked. He looked from the ledger to her face. "Hopkins has managed Yorkshire for 20 years. My father hired him."
"Then your father hired a thief,"
Beatrice replied, leaning over the desk and pointing a slightly ink-stained finger at a column of figures. "Look here. He is reporting a 30% drop in wheat yields due to blight for 3 consecutive seasons. Yet the mill receipts from the neighboring estate, which shares the exact same soil and weather patterns, show record production." Edmund frowned, pulling the ledger closer. "Furthermore," Beatrice continued tapping the page, "he claims to have spent £4,000 repairing the slate roofs of the tenant cottages over the winter. I cross-referenced this with the quarry invoices. Only a fraction of that slate was purchased. The rest of the money has vanished." Edmund scanned the numbers. His jaw tightened, the familiar ridge of muscle leaping along his scarred cheek. He was silent for a long minute. When he finally looked up,
His expression was a mix of dark fury and profound astonishment.
"My cousin Alistair," Edmund said quietly. "He spent 2 months in Yorkshire last autumn. He claimed he was hunting."
"He was hunting for a slush fund," Beatrice corrected. "Hopkins is cooking the books, skimming the profits, and funneling the excess directly to your heir to cover gambling debts. It is remarkably lazy accounting. A child could have spotted it if they bothered to look." Edmund leaned back in his chair. He stared at Beatrice. She stood before him with ink on her hands, wearing a dressing gown, aggressively dismantling a fraud that his own solicitors had missed. The delicate, shrinking bride he had imagined buying was entirely absent. In her place stood a general.
"You read the ledgers," he murmured. "I told you I was a practical woman," Beatrice said, crossing her arms. "I refuse to let a parasitic gambler dismantle my husband's estate while I sit in a parlor embroidering cushions. So, what are we going to do about Mr. Hopkins?" The corner of Edmund's mouth, the unscarred side, twitched upward. It was a slow, dangerous, utterly genuine smile. It transformed his face entirely. "We are going to fire him," Edmund said, his voice dropping into a dark, gravelly register of shared intent. "And then we are going to sever Alistair's allowance entirely. Let him rot in Macau."
"Excellent," Beatrice said briskly. She turned toward the door.
"I will have Mrs. Higgins send up a fresh pot of coffee. We have 3 more estates to audit before lunch."
A month passed. The rhythm of Hawley House shifted from a silent tomb to a fortress preparing for war. Beatrice and Edmund spent their mornings in the study, systematically tearing apart the corrupted structures of the Duke's holdings. They ate their meals together at the center of the mahogany table, debating crop rotation and tenant laws. They slept in the same bed every night. The mechanical transaction had evolved into an ironclad partnership. Then the heavy cream envelope arrived. It was a royal summons to a ball hosted by the Duke of Wellington at Apsley House. It was not an invitation, it was a mandate. To decline would be a direct insult to the crown. Edmund stood by the window in the study, staring down at the busy street. The invitation sat on his desk like a venomous snake. His knuckles were white where he gripped his cane. The quiet sanctuary they had built was about to be breached.
"I will not force you to go," Edmund said, his voice tight. "I can send regrets citing my health. They will whisper, but they whisper anyway. I will not drag you into a room full of people waiting to tear you apart for marrying me." Beatrice looked up from her paperwork. She set her pen down carefully.
"Edmund, look at me."
He turned his head slowly. "They exiled me the moment I danced with you. They have spent a month calling me a desperate, money-grubbing spinster," Beatrice said calmly. "If we hide, we prove them right. We prove that we are ashamed. I'm not ashamed of you, and I'm certainly not afraid of them." Edmund's throat worked. He looked at her, his dark eye bright with a sudden fierce loyalty. "You will be a target." "Let them aim," Beatrice said coldly. "I have thick skin." The night of the ball, Beatrice did not dress to blend in. She dressed for battle. She chose a gown of deep liquid emerald silk, cut severely with no lace, no ruffles, no apologies. It was a dress meant to command a room, not soften it. When she entered her sitting room, Edmund was waiting. He wore stark black, as always, but he wore his military medals pinned to his chest, a rare concession to the host. He looked up, and his breath hitched visibly.
He crossed the room slowly. In his hand, he held a long, flat velvet box. He snapped it open. Inside rested the Hawley diamonds. It was a staggering collar of stones, heavy and blindingly bright, a piece of jewelry that had belonged to the Duchesses of Hawley for 3 centuries. Edmund stepped behind her. He placed the cold, heavy diamonds around her neck, his calloused fingers brushing the nape of her neck as he fastened the clasp.
"You look..." He paused, struggling for the word.
"Formidable."
"Good," Beatrice said, turning to face him. She reached out and adjusted the lapel of his black coat. "Shall we go terrify London?" The arrival of the Duke and Duchess of Hawley at Apsley House was a seismic event. When the footman banged his staff on the marble floor and announced their names, the massive ballroom went dead silent. The music played on, but the conversation evaporated. Beatrice placed her hand on Edmund's arm. She felt the heavy, rigid tension in his muscle. She pressed her fingers into his sleeve, a silent anchor. "I am here. We are doing this." They walked into the room. Click, drag, click. The sea of silk and broadcloth parted. Eyes darted toward Edmund's ruined face, then snapped to the blazing diamonds at Beatrice's throat. They saw a crippled, scarred man. But beside him, they saw a woman whose chin was raised, whose gaze was flat and challenging, radiating absolute, unyielding authority. They made their way toward the perimeter. As they walked, Beatrice spotted her Aunt Sybil standing near a pillar. Sybil looked pale, her eyes locked on the enormous diamonds resting against her niece's collarbone. Beatrice did not smile. She simply held Sybil's gaze until the older woman broke eye contact and looked at the floor. "They are staring," Edmund muttered under his breath, his jaw locked. "Let them," Beatrice murmured back. "They are looking at the most powerful couple in the room." A man stepped directly into their path. It was Lord Pelham, a viciously ambitious peer known for his sharp tongue and lack of boundaries. He offered a shallow, insulting bow. "Hawley." Pelham sneered, his eyes flicking to the burn scars with naked distaste. "A rare sight. And your new duchess. I must confess, Miss Croft, forgive me. Your Grace, we were all quite shocked by the speed of your nuptials. One assumes you found the Hawley vaults incredibly persuasive." A low murmur rippled through the immediate crowd. It was a direct, calculated insult meant to humiliate them both. Edmund's hand tightened on his cane, a dangerous, explosive anger darkening his face. He stepped forward to speak. Beatrice stopped him with a firm squeeze of his arm. She stepped slightly ahead of her husband. She looked Pelham up and down, her expression one of mild, clinical pity. "Lord Pelham." Beatrice said, her voice carrying clearly over the quiet crowd. "I find myself equally shocked by your presence here. My husband's solicitors informed me just this morning that you recently remortgaged your Sussex estate for the third time. I was under the impression men in such dire financial straits preferred to stay home and save the carriage fare." The silence in the room sharpened into a razor. Pelham's face drained of color, turning a sickly mottled gray. To have one's secret financial ruin exposed so brutally, so calmly by a woman, was a social death sentence. "How dare you?" Pelham choked out. "I dare, because my husband is too polite to mention it," Beatrice said coolly. "If you ever speak to the Duke of Hawley with such disrespect again, I will buy your Sussex estate and turn it into an orphanage for feral cats. Now step aside. You're blocking the air." Pelham stumbled backward, dissolving into the crowd like a ghost. Beatrice turned back to Edmund. She did not look flustered. She merely smoothed her emerald skirt. "Shall we find a glass of champagne?" Edmund stared at her. The anger had vanished from his face, replaced by a look of profound, staggering awe. He looked at the woman who had not only demanded to dance with a monster, but who had just publicly drawn blood to defend him. He shifted his cane. He did not offer her his arm to lean on. He offered her his hand. "Yes, Beatrice." The ruined Duke set a genuine, fierce smile touching the scarred corner of his mouth. "I believe we shall." The carriage ride back to Hawley House was governed by an entirely different breed of silence. It was not the cold, vibrating dread of their wedding day. It was an electric, heavy atmosphere, thick with adrenaline and the lingering thrill of a public slaughter. Edmund did not retreat into the shadows of the velvet bench. He sat forward, his cane braced between his boots, his dark eye locked entirely on Beatrice. The street lamps flickered through the glass, casting passing bands of gold over the sharp, unyielding line of her jaw and the heavy diamonds resting at her throat. "You are a terrifying woman," Edmund finally said. His voice was a low, rough scrape in the dark. "Pelham is a bully," Beatrice replied smoothly,
removing her leather gloves finger by finger. Bullies rely on the polite silence of their betters to survive. I simply removed the silence. You made an enemy of a desperate man. I made a public example, she corrected, finally looking at him. The rest of them will think twice before they stare at you like a museum exhibit. We established the borders of our territory tonight, Edmund. No one crosses them.
He let out a short, harsh breath that might have been a laugh. He reached across the small space between them. He did not ask permission. He gripped her bare hand, his calluses scraping against her skin, and pressed her knuckles to his mouth. He kissed her hand right over the crest of the Hawley ring. It was a raw, fierce gesture of absolute surrender. When the carriage pulled up to the limestone steps of their estate, they did not separate in the grand foyer. Edmund did not retreat to the west wing. He followed the heavy rustle of her emerald silk up the sweeping marble staircase. Click, drag, click. Inside her bedchamber, the fire was blazing. Beatrice walked to the mirror to unfasten the diamonds. Her fingers struggled with the heavy gold clasp. Let me, Edmund murmured. He stepped behind her. He did not look at her reflection. He looked at the living woman. His large, scarred hands brushed the nape of her neck, releasing the clasp. The heavy stones slid away, pooling on the mahogany dresser like ice. He did not step back. He wrapped his arms around her waist, pulling her back against his chest. He buried his face in the curve of her neck, inhaling the scent of her skin. The contract, Edmund said quietly, his breath warm against her collarbone. It dictated that this was a transaction, a duty. I remember the terms, Beatrice whispered, leaning her weight back into his solid frame. I wish to break them, he said. He turned her around to face him. The firelight caught the deep ruined grooves of his face, but he did not flinch away from the illumination. He let her see the desperate, hungry truth in his eye. I do not want an arrangement, Beatrice. I want my wife. Beatrice reached up, framing his face with both hands. Her thumb stroked the edge of the burn scar on his jaw. Then take her. There was no darkness that night. There was no mechanical, silent obligation. There was only the frantic, heated collision of two people who had spent their lives bracing against the cold. Edmund loved her with a desperate, grounded reverence, mapping the lines of her body with a fierce attention that left no room for ghosts or insecurities.
By the time the snow began to fall in late December, the Hawley estate ledgers were entirely black. Alistair's frantic demands for money were being burned unopened in the study fireplace, and Beatrice's dresses were growing tight around the waist. The ton kept its distance. Beatrice and Edmund attended only the engagements they chose. When they walked into a room, society parted for them no longer out of disgust, but out of a healthy, deeply ingrained fear. They were untouchable.
The true test of their fortress came in the sweltering heat of August. The labor began before dawn. By noon, Hawley House was a battleground. Beatrice lay in the massive gold-draped bed, her face gray with pain, her hair plastered to her forehead with sweat. The high society physician, Dr. Eris, stood at the foot of the bed, wiping his hands on a bloody towel.
You must leave the room. Your Grace. Eris demanded nervously, looking at the towering, terrifying figure in black standing by the window. It is not proper. The Duchess requires... If you tell me to leave my own wife again, Eris, I will throw you through that window. Edmund snarled.
He crossed the room, his cane hitting the floor with a violent, rhythmic crack. He dropped the cane by the bed and sat on the edge of the mattress. He ignored the blood. He ignored the screaming. He took Beatrice's thrashing hand in both of his, anchoring her. I am right here, he said, his gravelly voice cutting through the panic in the room. Look at me, Beatrice. Look at me. She opened her eyes, finding the familiar scarred face that had become her entire world. She gripped his hands hard enough to bruise the bone. It hurts, she gasped, stripping away all her iron composure. I know, he said fiercely, pressing a kiss to her damp forehead. Fight it. You're the most stubborn creature God ever put on this earth. Fight.
She fought. For 3 more agonizing hours, she crushed his hands and tore the air from her lungs until finally, a sharp, furious cry pierced the stifling heat of the room. Dr. Aris stepped back, breathless. A boy, Your Grace. A healthy son. The room fell away. The ledgers, the society, the burning beams of the past, they all dissolved into the sound of that single outraged cry. The nurse cleaned the child and wrapped him in a white linen blanket before stepping hesitantly toward Edmund. Edmund reached out. His hands were shaking. He took the small, impossibly light bundle into his arms. He looked down at the tiny, red, furious face. The baby blinked, waving a tiny fist in the air, and suddenly settled as Edmund pulled him against his chest. Edmund sat back down on the edge of the bed. He leaned over so Beatrice could see. She was exhausted pale, but her eyes were bright and incredibly sharp. "He needs a name," Edmund whispered. A tear slipped down his cheek, tracking through the deep valleys of the scars he had hated for 5 long years. He didn't bother to wipe it away. "He needs to learn to keep a ledger," Beatrice murmured, reaching out to touch the baby's incredibly soft cheek. Then her fingers trailed up to rest lightly against Edmund's scarred jaw. "And he needs to learn from his father how to survive." Edmund looked from his son to his wife. The transaction was over. The debt was paid. But as he sat in the ruins of the Life Society had assigned him holding the entirely new world they had built from scratch, he knew he had never been richer. That concludes the journey of Beatrice and the Duke of Hawley, a story proving that true power isn't found in a flawless reputation, but in the courage to face the world exactly as you are. They defied the suffocating rules of society, turned a cold contract into a fierce partnership, and built an unshakable empire on their own terms. If you love this grounded, deeply human romance, hit that like button, share this video with fellow historical drama fans, and subscribe to the channel for more original, unyielding stories. Leave a comment below with your favorite moment.